From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Whatever you think about fighting crime, you likely agree that the policies in place ought to do what they say they're going to do. We'll chat with an expert at Duke University who puts criminal justice policies to the test. Some state lawmakers want to loosen restrictions on craft distilleries in North Carolina. They're tying their arguments to the state economy. A bill to help law enforcement officers across the state track missing people more easily has generated some Fourth Amendment concerns. You'll learn why. And we'll hear from an environmental expert who's concerned about new North Carolina rules dealing with livestock. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
How will North Carolina lawmakers spend the tax money that you've worked hard to earn and then paid into the state treasury? We're one step closer to an answer to that question. The North Carolina Senate has now proposed its plan for the new operating budget, scheduled to take effect July 1st. It follows the House and the governor doing the same. Joe Coletti is a senior fellow with the John Locke Foundation. He's joining us now with a look at what the Senate leaders would like to do with the cash. Joe, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here.
Give us an overall sense of how the Senate compares in terms of spending and priorities with the House and the governor.
Well, the Senate spends the exact same dollar amount as the House, at least.
Interesting.
So that part is good. They both spend less than the governor. The Senate actually sets aside more money because after the House passed its budget, we got the April numbers for tax revenues, and they came in much higher than expected with expectations for the rest of the year. So they have $500 million more than the House had to do stuff with. And they save that and put it into capital instead of into the operating budget and leave more on the bottom line. But the overall spending is the same amount.
We've heard a lot of discussion in the news media about spending on education. Mm-hmm. Give us a sense of what the Senate does with education spending, teachers, pay raises, that kind of thing.
Right. So, yeah, it's the same dollar amount as the House, but the way they spend the money is different because the House had larger pay raises for teachers. There was a little strike that happened in the meantime. I mean, it's not a strike because it's not a union, but there was a big protest in Raleigh from the teachers association in Raleigh, and I don't know if that had an effect, but the Senate is providing less in pay raises and doing to teachers, providing more in pay raises to state employees, because there is also some talk over the past few months that state employees over the last 10 years have not done nearly as well as teachers. And what they give to teachers and principals, they provide some more money to principals, but they also do more in bonus payments and incentive payments to one-time payments to teachers and principals than either the House or the governor. So they take a different approach to that, and teacher salary is the largest portion of what we spend on education.
That's going to be fascinating because there's going to have to be a coming together, so to speak, between the House and the Senate. And if they use the money in different ways, that could be a pretty interesting negotiation.
Yeah, and so that's the next step is that the House passed its version, the Senate has now passed its, and in the next week they'll have to come up with who is going to be on that conference committee from both chambers to come up with that compromise so that they will eventually then pass, send on to the governor so that he can veto.
We've also heard much discussion about Health and Human Services,
right,
how much money, and in particular the issue of Medicaid and whether or not we will add 500,000 to 600,000 people to the Medicaid rolls. The governor is a huge supporter of Medicaid expansion under Obamacare. What about the Senate leaders?
The Senate leaders are not. So the Senate and the House have, and that's why I said that we're expecting the governor to veto this bill. Because the Senate and the House, one of the things they do agree on, besides the total dollar amount, is that there is no Medicaid expansion. They don't see that as affordable. They don't see it as a good use of money. The Senate's put some more money into some specific areas but Medicaid expansion is not on that list, and it will not be on that list.
Did the Senate budget include some sort of appropriation for folks who have already qualified for Medicaid but have been on a wait list for services?
Yeah,
that's kind of how they approach it.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting that they don't want to expand it, though, to that 500,000 to 600,000 people. That's right. Going to be another key point. As you mentioned, the governor may well veto this if it doesn't end up having that in it. You've also been looking at borrowing mm-hmm. and saving issues. What do Senate leaders do in that area?
Yeah, so because there is that $500 million extra, there's also another $190 million in expected revenue this year. The Senate rebuilds relatively quickly the money that was spent last year from the savings reserve account. The savings reserve is the state's rainy day fund. Last year we had literal rainy days with Hurricane Florence and and the legislature took $750 million from the rainy day fund to help with recovery and relief efforts. And that's state money. It's not that we don't have to wait on like the federal money. That's money that's already there and being spent. But the House and the governor were slower to refill those coffers. The Senate, because there is that extra money available, but they put about $400 million aside this year and another $700 million aside next year into the savings account. They leave $700 million on the bottom line, which is still available to be used. And then they also put $1.3 billion into capital funds, which includes debt service. But instead of borrowing, which the governor would have done, to build schools and community colleges and do some water projects, the Senate pays for that from the availability. And so they've talked about this for some time, and this is the first step of that they're going to put over $200 million aside for schools, community colleges, and other projects.
So it sounds like the Senate leaders have made good in their budget plan what they've talked about before. They endorse the so-called pay-as-you-go way versus borrowing money and then having to pay back the debt plus interest.
Right. So yeah, with using pay-as-you-go, we're paying down the debt service that we have on money that's already been spent and projects that have already happened, and instead putting that into new projects as they come up, and the money is then spent, and so there's less money that has to go into debt. So future generations aren't going to have to pay for what we're getting now. They'll be paying for stuff that they're getting at the time.
Joe, over the last number of years in these operating budgets, we have seen a lot of tax relief, tax reform efforts from the Republican-led mm-hmm. General Assembly. Are they continuing with their tax reform plans?
Yes, they are. There are a couple of areas that they're changing. One is the franchise tax. They have been working on the corporate income tax. And the franchise tax is another business tax that is based on the total value of the company. And they're reducing the rates and transforming some of how that is calculated. They're also reforming how the corporate income tax is calculated to make that an easier thing. And in both cases, it shares the by reducing the franchise tax and changing how they do the corporate income tax, it shifts more of the burden to companies that are out of the state, which encourages companies. The idea is to locate in North Carolina and to provide some help to individuals. They increase the standard deduction by $1,000.
That's essentially what we call the zero tax bracket.
Right. Yes.
And I think that doesn't get enough really conversation, particularly you would think that those who approach things more from the progressive side mm-hmm. of ideology would endorse that, because that helps the lower income people the most.
It does. And our colleague Mitch Kokai has written a lot about that and doing comparisons of the bank teller versus the bank president, right? That the bank teller benefits a lot from an additional $1,000 taken off their income tax, which is out of their income, not their tax goes down by 5% of that. But the CEO has less benefit from that because their tax burden is so much more because they have such a higher tax, because they have more income and are paying more taxes.
Lastly, Joe, we know you said the conference committee will be formed, and the House and the Senate will have to get together on this. What do you think is going to be the flashpoint between those two groups?
Between the House and the Senate, the probably the teacher pay question, if the House will be willing to have the lower teacher pay and some of the other issues related to capital and things like that. But they're largely in agreement, so it shouldn't be too bad for them.
Once they come up with that, we'll have you back. Joe Coletti is Senior Fellow with the John Locke Foundation. You can read all of his work at johnlocke.org. Joe, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly. But our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. People hold a wide range of views about how to address crime, but there's at least one area where there ought to be widespread agreement. The steps we take to address crime ought to do what advocates say they'll do. And that's where our next guest comes in. Brandon Garrett is a professor at the Duke Law School. He recently spoke to the John Locke Foundation about research projects seeking to make criminal justice more evidence-based. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So when we talk about making criminal justice more evidence-based, what are we talking about?
It means a number of different things. So quite a bit of my research looks at wrongful convictions. Obviously, it's not good evidence if it's literally false evidence that's convicting someone. And a lot of my early work, I've studied what causes eyewitnesses to get it wrong. Obviously, they're not intending to. What causes people to falsely confess? How to improve forensic science so it can be more accurate. And so all those accuracy-related issues have to do with getting the evidence right so that we catch guilty people and clear innocent people. But there's a lot more work happening across the country looking at not just, okay, no one wants innocent people in jail, but how do we rely on better evidence to inform policy? How do we think about when is imprisonment appropriate and for how long and when it isn't it? And what can we do to have better outcomes when people come out of jail or prison, since almost everyone inevitably does? What are better ways to combat crime?
I would suspect that a lot of people haven't really spent a lot of time thinking about the role that evidence plays in here. You basically think there's a crime, there's a penalty. Because we've had crimes for many years, we all seem to know what the right penalty is, but it hasn't necessarily been based on evidence.
Well, yeah, and so actually, you know, a lot of the modern approaches towards sentencing and criminal enforcement aren't that old. Things really changed in the 1970s because there was a huge crime wave, both homicides, other types of crimes, and people weren't overreacting. People were reacting to some really difficult problems. And all of a sudden in the mid-90s, crime started going down, and that's created more breathing room. We don't know why crime went up, by the way, or why it went down. Criminologists don't really have a good fix on that, which is also really disturbing for those of us who think, okay, as lawyers, you know, we want to get criminal laws right, and that's a good way to deter crime or prevent crime. We don't know why crime goes up and down. But what a lot of people are thinking about today is, well, how long do sentences need to be? And are there better ways to prevent crime and integrate people to society when they inevitably do get out of jail and prison? And we need research on that. We need research on how to handle the connection between mental health and the criminal justice system. And I think lots of people are thinking about that today. Lots of people are also thinking about how do we handle addiction, especially with the opioid epidemic in North Carolina and around the country. You can't, you know, use jail or prison as a blunt instrument to prevent the spread of addiction. There's certainly a role for criminal law and criminal punishment, but we're realizing that there also needs to be a medical role. And how to get that medical legal connection right is another challenge.
We are chatting with Brandon Garrett, professor at the Duke Law School.
I think some people might be listening to us and they'll say to themselves, hey, this all sounds good, but if someone commits a crime, they need to face a punishment. It needs to be stiff enough that not only will they not do it again, but it'll deter other people. If that's the mindset, mm-hmm. and we aren't thinking about the evidence of what works or what doesn't work, what kinds of problems does that create?
Well, there's not a lot of evidence that people, for all types of crimes at least, are deterred and think that way about this is what the sentence is, this is what I'm facing. A lot of people have no idea what's in these criminal sentencing statutes. And, you know, maybe a white-collar offender knows something about because they have access to lawyers and can get advice about, look, if we get prosecuted, this is what might happen. I actually think a lot of white-collar offenders aren't thinking about law either. They're thinking about making the business successful and taking risks. But regular offenders often have no idea. So here's just an example, and it may sound trivial, but there's research I'm working on with colleagues at Duke looking at this. You know, about one in every eight adult drivers in North Carolina has a suspended driver's license. And that's an enormous consequence. It means you can't get around, you can't go to the doctor, can't go to work, legally at least. What we're finding, though, is that huge numbers of people, and this is, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, have these suspended licenses because they didn't show up in court for a traffic case, a traffic ticket, or they didn't pay the traffic ticket. But we're finding that many of these people talk about not being deterred, had no idea that their license was suspended. You know, later they find out because police stop them for something else and they say, you know, your license is suspended. And they say, what do you mean? You're saying I don't have a license? Here's my license. I have a license. But, you know, when people don't show up in court because they don't get the letter in the mail, you know, they're poor. They live in rental housing. They change addresses. The court has the wrong address on file. They don't get the notice saying they're supposed to show up. Then there are these terrible consequences. And, you know, obviously, if people lose their jobs because they don't have a driver's license, that doesn't help us get the tickets paid. And there's a lot of thought going into, okay, do we need to be imposing these fines and fees across society, which may trap people in debt and make it harder for us to get the good things that we want out of the law?
Obviously, this is a topic that is ripe for a lot of academic research. How much has the research translated into actually getting policies changed?
So that's obviously a goal. Whenever you do research, you hope that if you come up with good solutions that people will follow them. One area of research that I've worked on a lot is on eyewitness memory. And in North Carolina, actually, it's been many years now that good lineup practices have been in place, and which can really prevent wrongful convictions. It's been slower going in Virginia, but one thing that I did with my research team is we gave advice to the crime commission and helped to inform a model policy that went out to all law enforcement in Virginia to describe what steps you need to follow to show photos to an eyewitness to make sure that you're not affecting their memory, that you're testing their memory without potentially changing it. So that's one area where I feel like we had a really good impact in Virginia. On the mental health side, we did some research starting 2 years ago trying to identify rural jurisdictions that were doing a really good job of using best practices to do early intervention. People maybe not convicted of anything, but first encounters with the police, and police have a feeling that someone might have serious mental health needs. How do they refer that person to services before things get bad? And so we provided budgets to the legislature, and the lawmakers in Virginia ended up awarding a substantial amount of money to replicate what those rural districts were doing so that other rural districts that don't have lots of psychiatric services could start to provide mental health services to avoid criminal justice problems down the road.
In the brief time that we have left, when it comes to adding evidence-based methods to criminal justice, are we kind of picking at the edges here, or is there substantial room for improvement in terms of adding evidence-based tools to what we do?
I think there is substantial room to do new work. For example, in Virginia and other districts are looking at this, we can use risk assessments to identify low-risk offenders. And so now if all you care about is just we should impose the same punishment on everyone to deter, then you wouldn't use that approach. But what Virginia lawmakers thought in the 90s was if we know that there are people who are really low risk, who are really unlikely to do it again, yes, we will convict them, but they can serve their sentence supervised in the community at enormous cost savings and with social benefits. Now, what we found is that judges aren't using that as often as they could, and there are many thousands of people who can benefit from that. But the chances that they will do anything again are remote. And number of prosecutors here in North Carolina are thinking about the same thing. What can we do to do diversion? If there are people who are low risk, do we need to have them in jail? Can we supervise them in the community? Can we provide better treatment than we could in a jail setting?
Brandon Garrett, he is professor at the Duke Law School. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know, same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. A proposal to loosen North Carolina's alcohol regulations is reigniting debate about the government's proper role. One specific proposal would grant more freedom to craft distilleries. The idea doesn't appeal to Republican State Representative Pat Hurley of Randolph County.
This is just another exception to our ABC system. This would allow distilleries to sell spirits just like ABC stores. Our control system is what it should be for selling spirits. Should be left to the local ABC boards. Control versus private systems. Our system of control is predicated upon the need to control the retail sale of spirits. If distilleries are allowed to sell spirits at retail, then who will be next? Convenience stores, Walmart, Sam's Club. The United States already has serious problems with alcohol, and particularly with underage drinking, but it has not reached the point of an epidemic like the UK. This could happen in the U.S., and it's very possible at any time with it being appearing to be that it's pushing market forces to push prices lower and make alcohol very, very much available. I beg you to please stop some of this that they're trying to do.
On the other side of the argument, State House Republican leader John Bell of Wayne County. Bell asked colleagues not to think of the craft distillery proposal as just an alcohol bill.
I was involved in the distillery legislation years ago, and I know by some of the bills I run here, people think I probably partake in a lot of this, but actually I don't. I don't even participate in craft beer or drink wine. I drink good, real beer like Natural Light. The fact is that this is an industry. This is a booming industry in our state, and if we took the word alcohol away from it, or you substituted wine, or you substituted ice cream, anything like that, every single one of us would jump on board and say, yes, yes, we want the jobs, we want the revenue, we want to watch what's happening in our small towns as these distilleries are popping up and growing. We would all be for that. But you throw the word liquor in there, and it scares people to death. The fact is this is a booming industry in our state. We need to unleash it just like we did the wineries. Now we have a wine caucus where we promote grapes and we promote wine and we talk about the wonderful things that are happening with our wineries all over the state. You know, same situation happened years ago with the craft brew. Look what the breweries have done for downtowns all across our state. Booming breweries, businesses are coming back. The distilleries are trying to do the same thing, and this will unleash them because this is a actual jobs bill. Don't look at it as an alcohol bill. This is actually a jobs bill.
Advocates group the distillery proposal with other proposed alcohol reforms. Those ideas need support from both the State House and Senate to become law. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us, listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock. Just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. Fourth Amendment rights got the spotlight during a recent debate in the North Carolina House of Representatives. The discussion focused on House Bill 608. It would allow state law enforcement agents to use technology to track a missing person without a warrant. That last provision bothered Republican State Representative Keith Kidwell of Beaufort County.
In referencing initially the United States Constitution, Fourth Amendment, the rights of the people to be secure in their persons, house, papers, and effects against unreasonable search and seizure shall not be violated, and no warrant shall be issued but upon probable cause. I don't think I need to continue on that. This would circumvent the warrant and probable cause, violating your Fourth Amendment rights. Also, Benjamin Franklin is noted to have said, those who would give up their essential liberty for temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety. I would say this also violates Benjamin Franklin's thoughts in regard to this. I've also contacted several attorneys in reference to this, and all of them agree that this would be an egregious violation of your Fourth Amendment rights. I encourage you to protect the liberties of the people you represent, which is what you were sworn and sent here to do.
Kidwell's protest prompted a response from the bill's sponsor. Republican Alan McNeil represents Randolph County.
This bill actually raises the current standard in the law that has been in effect in North Carolina for probably 20 or 30 years. It raises it from reasonable suspicion to probable cause. So it actually makes it harder to get an ex parte order. So it's not lowering the standard, it's actually raising the standard. And the only change is, and it is adding an emergency situation for a missing person, a runaway child that is in imminent danger. There is a process in the bill for the emergency order. It has to, As soon as the trap and trace, the agent has to contact the judge to begin the process of getting an order. And if the judge turns it down, the trap and trace has to be immediately cease. And then also the bill has a process for destroying the evidence. I believe this is very well written, and I believe it protects rights.
Republican Representative Pat Hurley of Randolph County also sponsored the bill.
This will help find people who are kidnapped, who are gone away from home or run away. This will help people, the law enforcement, the SBI, to find them quicker, to give them a chance to live. I hope that you will support this bill and vote yes on this. Because it is important. It does have your warrants. It does have probable cause. I do hope that you will support this.
More than one representative raised Fourth Amendment concerns. Republican Michael Speciale represents Craven County.
An act to allow the SBI to conduct warrantless use of pen register and trap and trace device. Warrantless use. For those that are sitting around saying it doesn't violate the Constitution, it does. Period. This isn't the first one we've seen. Or the first type of bill that we've seen. We're seeing cameras on the roads and all kinds of things that are violating our privacy, that can track us through a city, that can, now we're looking at warrantless. Do we trust the FBI after what we've seen that's been going on over the last few years up there in Washington? Do we trust our government? The whole point of the Constitution is because we should never put ourselves in a position where we allow government to cross certain lines. And you and I are government, and it's up to us. Our number one primary duty, is not the budget. It is to protect the rights and liberties of the citizens. And the moment that we forget that, we don't need to be up here. And while there's a million things that we can do to make it easier for law enforcement, there's a million things we can do in this individual case or that individual case. The bottom line is, at some point, these things do get abused. That's the purpose for the Constitution. That's the purpose for the law. So that because we are a nation of laws, and we must follow those laws, and we must follow our Constitution. We can't just sit around and keep saying, yeah, let's do this. I support law enforcement. I support it 1,000%, but not at the cost of my liberty, not at the price of my freedom, and not at the price of your freedom. And we got to quit we've got to start remembering that as we look at bills like this that can do this or can do that, or should we put a GPS on somebody's car without a warrant, or should we do this or that? We are responsible for protecting the rights, the freedoms, the liberties of the citizens. And the minute we forget that, we start crossing these lines. And if we vote for this bill, we are crossing yet another line.
Other lawmakers pushed back. Republican John Hardister of Guilford County asked bill sponsor Alan McNeil about the bill's safeguards.
This would only apply in an emergency situation, that it's very important for public safety, and that there's procedures that would govern the process. President McNeil, would you mind explaining the procedures in the bill?
I don't mind at all. There is a court procedure. It's not warrantless except for in the emergency situations if a person is missing. What the procedures are is that when an agent installs a pen register, a trap and trace pursuant to this subsection, the agent must immediately seek an order approving the installation or use in accordance with this statute. So seeking an order means he's got to immediately start the process with the judge to get the warrant. In the absence of an authorizing warrant, the use of the pen register, trap and trace shall immediately terminate. So if he doesn't get it, he can't go forward.
Republican Representative Carson Smith of Pender County weighed in.
Courts have said in certain emergency situations, if there is an imminent threat to your life or your family's life, we can go as far as to entering your house if we think something anywhere is about to happen. Let me just say this. To get the location immediately of a cell phone of a loved one that's in danger while you're still working through the process of getting the court order, I don't believe is a violation of the Constitution. And if it's your family member that you want law enforcement to find, and you're standing right there, you're going to want us to do it.
Republican Representative David Rogers of Rutherford County explained he could understand both sides of the argument.
I agree with Representative Kidwell. This Constitution, the protection of our rights, is one of the most important things. I agree with Representative Speciale that we need to guard this as much as we possibly can, and this is definitely a road that we need to be very careful about. I agree with Representative McNeil. When I first heard this thing mentioned, when he said the standard is going to be raised from reasonable suspicion to probable cause, I thought, good. That standard needs to be raised, and that's what this bill does. It raises that standard from just a reasonable suspicion that something may be gone to probable cause. And as much as I'm all for protecting all of our rights, if my daughter is missing or is in risk of dying, please, somebody let the police ping her phone and find her and do whatever they need to do to find her to save her life.
The discussion about safeguards didn't persuade Michael Speciale.
As someone who served a career in the Marines, it hurts my heart anytime I hear any American say, for this, I would gladly give up my rights. One thing that has made this country unique is that the American citizens control their government, and we are a government of laws, and the laws start with the Constitution.
Regardless of Fourth Amendment concerns, the bill cleared the state house by a vote of 101-11. It needs support from the state Senate to become law. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Costly new groundwater monitoring requirements, troubling new exposure to lawsuits, additional layers of record keeping. They are the new triple threat to North Carolina farmers who raise hogs, turkeys, and cattle. In an op-ed published in the Fayetteville Observer, John Locke Foundation senior fellow Don Vandervaart writes about state regulators' update to the permit that's required of animal feed operators. It's an update executed, he says, behind closed doors and without the benefit of scientific studies. Don joins us now with this curious, some would say troubling story. Don, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Let's make sure people understand what we're talking about here when we talk about these animals. We're talking about raising animals that farmers would then sell or animals that will be slaughtered for food, correct?
Right. North Carolina has a very large agricultural industry. It's some 17% of our budget. A lot of that is raising hogs, cattle, and poultry.
So this is a huge component of our economy, and people who live in the more urban areas of the state may not really realize how important it is to North Carolina, except for me, when you're driving along Interstate 40 from Raleigh over to the Triad, you may see the truck carrying some of those pigs.
Right. But it is worth hundreds of millions of dollars and employs a lot of North Carolinians.
Now, our listeners might be thinking, Don, well, when you're talking about animals, then there should be some rules and some regulations. There might be issues of waste or issues of odor on the farms. What's caught your eye about this new update to this general permit that's required of these operators?
Well, Donna, first, you're entirely correct. In North Carolina, being a leader in the United States in both hog and poultry industries, already have a lot of regulatory procedural and protections in place. 20 years ago, more than 20 years ago, Governor Easley spearheaded an effort to put requirements on specifically swine operations. That led to a lot of scientific studies being performed, including over at NC State. And we had rules put in place for odor prevention, the like. So, we are one of the we also have this permit that we're going to talk about, which is one of the most protective permit regimes in the United States. DEQ themselves admits it's one of the strongest out there.
And I should let our listeners know that, of course, you are the former secretary of the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality. You served under Governor Pat McCrory, so you're very knowledgeable about these permits and requirements.
Right. I was there over those decades where we did develop these regulations.
So this new permit, it gets updated every few years, and that makes sense as well. Mm-hmm. But you're saying that this latest update really did not involve the farmers at all. And as I mentioned, that it's going to impose a lot of new rules and costs on them, and they had no say.
Well, what happened here was what appears to be a sue and settle sort of strategy. Yes, the general permit gets renewed every 5 years, and typically it's tweaked to update it based on things that might have occurred over that five-year period. In this case, we see significant additional requirements being placed in that general permit. And the substance of those changes were actually developed behind closed doors, as I said in the article, to the exclusion of the farmers in a settlement negotiation between the department and some third-party special interest environmental groups. The results of that negotiation then did get taken out to public notice, but ultimately the majority of those requirements ended up in the general permit.
So, Don, that sounds inherently unfair because it sounds as if the critics of the industry were in helping to make the rules, but the people who would be impacted directly, the farmers, were kept out.
Well, and that's right. And typically when you develop environmental requirements, you'll see some scientific basis, scientific findings that have occurred because there's a concern. The department will go out and do the monitoring, do the testing, try to get an understanding of what the problem was, the both the level and the source. And then if they decide to go on, there is a legal or procedural path which the department goes through. And the idea there is to include everybody who's going to be impacted by this requirement. It seems that in this case, the substance of this general permit was developed without the benefit of either of those two paths.
Does that mean then that we're not really sure whether or not these new requirements, groundwater monitoring, additional layers of record keeping, really are necessary?
Well, this is the problem. About 10 years ago, there was a study done, commissioned by the Environmental Management Commission here in North Carolina, by the United States Geological Survey. And that the idea there was to find what kind of issues there might be in the water quality due to these kinds of farming operations. The study was exhaustive and was completed after a number of years, and it showed that none of the water quality standards were being violated. Now, we can do more studies, and that's a great idea. I'm always for more science. But in this case, it's not clear that there was a problem that this is intending to address. Similarly, there are some odor requirements in there. We already have odor regulations in place that are protective. So, again, this looks like a sue and settle type of strategy where you've got a third-party set of individuals who –
The critics of the industry.
Right, who sue the department who is sympathetic to them but who haven't been able to get these requirements in place in the past, both under Democrat or Republican regimes. And they then settle agreeing to do these things without the protective scientific findings or the protective regulatory procedures in place. They just bypass that.
So in this case, rather than sue and settle – somehow or another, it's ended up that the critics must have had a friendly audience within the regulators who are now running the show.
That's what it appears. Ordinarily, and this happened 10 years ago, they did petition, the same group petitioned, and the EMC very wisely, as I said, commissioned a scientific study. in this case, that was all bypassed. And it is a little troubling. It seems that the department is fine to go after our farming industry without the requisite safeguards having been followed.
Don, you're a scientist yourself. You've also been in charge of the state agency that regulates here in North Carolina. And you write in your piece that was published by the Fayetteville Observer that environmentalists should be the staunchest defenders of science before rulemaking. But it seems like, at least in this case, that that has been completely flipped on its head. So what gives?
It's very troubling. And the good news is I understand that the legislature has picked up a provision to slow this process down until it's been looked at both from a scientific standpoint and then the procedural steps to make sure that they're in place to protect the industry that's going to be impacted. And let's hope that goes forward.
What's been the reaction of farmers who are now subjected to all these additional requirements, knowing that the science has not been done yet, that might very well either endorse the rules or reject the rules?
Well, indeed, they have filed a petition as well in the Office of Administrative Hearings, which is their right when the agency has made a final agency action, as they have. So we'll see that play out in the courts. It's just it's just unfortunate that we've had to follow that the farmers have had to follow that path, and that the legislature have had to interject themselves into a process that's been well known for 30 years.
Don, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. Join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.